Every organization is plagued by destructive friction, the forces that make it harder, more complicated, or downright impossible to get anything done. Some forms of friction are incredibly useful, and leaders who attempt to improve workplace efficiency often make things even worse. Hey, it's Dustin, and you're listening to another episode of the Burleson Box. Today on the show, we talk to Bob Sutton, author of The Friction Project, how smart leaders make the right things easier and the wrong things harder. Drawing from 7 years of hands-on research, The Friction Project teaches leaders how to become friction fixers so that teams and organizations don't squander the zeal, damage the health, and throttle the creativity and productivity of good people, or burn through piles of cash and other precious resources in the process. I can't wait to share the lessons inside this episode, but first, here's a message from our sponsor. Dr. Burleson here. You've heard that real estate should be a part of every investor's portfolio, but maybe you're unsure where to start. My good friend and colleague, Dr. David Phelps, leads an investor community that has ditched the traditional Wall Street model for the stability of real estate assets. They are called Freedom Founders, and they do real estate really, really well. David's Freedom Blueprint reveals exactly how much you need to retire. Some of my top clients have done the program. They speak highly of David and his Freedom Blueprint. With the certainty of their passive real estate investments, Freedom Founders members are free to spend more time with family or even leave the practice altogether. David has put together some special resources for my listeners. To access, just text Dustin to 972-203-6960. Or go to freedomfounders.com/Burleson. Welcome, everyone. I am so honored and excited to speak with Bob Sutton, author of The Friction Project. Bob, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's great to talk with you, Dustin.
Your book is phenomenal. I'm curious. I know why you wrote it, because I read the intro drew me in, because I'm an adjunct faculty member, where I think the joke on the most recent movie, The Holdovers, is adjuncts are where the pay is zero and the respect is even less.
Yeah.
So tell me about Stanford. So you were in an amazing place. Tell me about what inspired you to do this project and to publish it into the book.
Well, I guess there's two things that led to this book. One is, as you are alluding to, just our personal experience with our own employers and all the other organizations that we deal with in life, that there was so much frustration that seemed unnecessary for us and other people. So the example you're talking about was, and it's the opening paragraph of the book, was one afternoon in the depth of the pandemic, actually one morning, a senior Stanford administrator, that's where I work, is at Stanford, sent a email, 1,266 words long, with a 7,466 word attachment, inviting all 2,000 Stanford faculty members to devote a Saturday to brainstorming on Zoom about a new sustainability school. And just the whole math of that whole thing is, gee, don't you have any respect for our time at all on every single dimension? That made us realize that this friction problem was an issue. And the longer, kind of like more supposedly intellectual issue that drove us is, this is the second book Huggy Rao and I did. We did an earlier book in 2014 on scaling, and we worked with all, and scaling is a hard thing to do, growing a company, and we worked with all these companies that their dreams came true. They got to scale, baby, scale, like Google, Facebook, Salesforce. And once they got really large and really complex, their leader said, oh my goodness, it's really hard to get things done here because we've got a mess of a bureaucracy. So this looked like a research and a practical problem that we hoped we could make some progress on.
It's such a valuable book. And right from the very beginning, the subtitle, you could just sit the book on your shelf and learn from it by reading the subtitle, right? We're trying to make the right things easier and the wrong things harder. But so many large organizations, bureaucracies. I think of calling customer service. Yes. I think of trying to rebook an airline flight. I think of visiting the bank.
Right.
They make the right things harder. And so you say in the book, quote, anyone who's tangled with this, the organizations, as an employee, or a customer, we've had these moments where we feel as if the overlords who imagined and run the place have no respect for our time, end quote. It reminds me of Chandler and Ross on an episode of Friends trying to cancel their gym membership. Right?
Oh, I remember that. Oh, yeah.
So you say it chips away at initiative and commitment and our zest for work. And I agree. I guess the question, that's the bad news. You say, so what's the good news? Like, how can we actually be a part of the solution? Or are we doomed to live in these horrible friction environments?
Well, yeah. So I like that question because Huggy and I, to be honest, and we're starting out in some ways that our conversation parallels our little journey, that we started out complaining. We talked to groups of executives, they'd complain. But then as we sort of dug into it, we realized that it didn't have to be this way in many organizations. And a lot of things can be done to, we're talking about unnecessary friction, to reduce unnecessary friction. In the gym membership, one is a really interesting example because that's something that in the book, we steal this phrase from somebody else. That's called a roach motel, where it's easy to check in and impossible to check out. And I had, well, as I was writing the book, and I didn't use the example I should have, I had an example where I tried to end my Financial Times, my FT subscription. I could not believe how difficult it was. And literally, I had to call someone, and I had to go through something like 15 descending sales pitches before the guy finally said yes. And I just said the same thing. I just want to end my subscription. I just want to, and I actually love the FT. They actually did two stories on our book, even. And Andrew Hill, who's our buddy there, I said, Andrew, why do you do this? And an interesting contrary case is Netflix. And we have the story in the book, which was that 2008, 2009, 2010, something like that, Netflix used to have a roach motel too, where the only way to cancel your subscription was to call in and say, I want to cancel my subscription. But a bunch of employees who were embarrassed by this complained to Reed Hastings, the CEO, and he was embarrassed by this. And so if you go to Netflix, there's just one button. It's really easy to cancel. In fact, I almost canceled my Netflix subscription a couple times while working on the book because it was too easy to do. And so we talked to people who worked at Netflix about why is this so easy, including Patty McCord, who was essentially head of HR for years. And she said, well, first of all, we didn't want to embarrass ourselves. But she said, second, we get much better data than our competitors do because when people quit, it's really sensitive because it's a sign that we're doing something wrong. We're not getting false data that's noisy. And the other thing is when people figure out how easy it is to quit, they're not afraid to come back when we get better because they know it's easy to quit again. And she argues that's one of the reasons why, well, they're winning in the long term. So I thought that was an interesting example.
It's a great example. And I've had the same challenge. I think the New York Times has made it a little bit easier, but I had the exact same challenge with Financial Times. And there's one that's even worse, and I can't remember it. But I had the same, I was just like, please, no, please, please cancel. I'm not reading it. I'm not even at that address anymore. And it was like, you're right, like 15 steps.
Yep.
And I said, hey, it should be just as easy. It should be a one-click cancel as is to one. And you know those support reps are like, I know, but I have to ask you these things in order to show that I'm doing my job. But don't you think also the pricing transparency to come back as a customer, you never know what the rate is going to be for the New York Times. Sometimes it's $1 for
right,
a year.
Right.
Sometimes it's, right. But with Netflix, it's just transparent pricing. It's a really great example. And I think obviously Netflix is probably, kicking butt compared to a lot of legacy media companies. So,
yeah, well, they have a longer term perspective. One thing I will say that's worth adding is that in a number of states, including the state I live, California, so-called roach motels are actually unlawful. So yes. Sometimes the laws help me. So it actually might be easier for me to cancel the New York Times than it is for people in other states.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I love that there's two sides of this coin. So reading through the book, it's like, okay, we've got all these things that are making our lives harder. But there are times where like we could remove too much friction. You've got a great example of the slow lane at a Dutch supermarket chain. Can we talk about the other side of this coin?
Oh sure. So in fact, that's another issue is that as we're writing the book, two kind of lessons emerge. One was there's actually stuff you can do about this, and there are companies, leaders who are making things better. And then also, gee, some things should be difficult and slow. And the one that you're talking about is the notion that in this world where we want everything to be frictionless and to move fast, a lot of times that's great. But there are some things in life, and there's some academic research, they call it unsavoring, where people want to slow down and enjoy the good things in life. And the example you're talking about is Jumbo Supermarkets. It's the biggest chain in the Netherlands, in Holland. And they experimented in just one store with a slow lane. And it's essentially for older people who want to have a nice chat with the clerk about personal stuff and to sort of slow down. And so they experimented. And there was a certain subset of customers who really liked that. And now they've scaled that out to at least 200 different stores in the Jumbo Supermarket. And to me, I'll be honest, the concept of getting in a supermarket lane that I know is going to move slow is not for me, but clearly it is for other customers.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I love that because it's not, you could have gone totally with this book on the remove friction, make things easier for customers, make it easier for employers and employees, but you know, there's always another side of the coin. And Roger Martin, who's been on the show, said, hey, there's an optimal amount of slack in any system, and it's never zero. It's never zero. But we want it, and our minds go like, let's move fast, right? Like Silicon Valley, move fast, break things. But at times, stopping to interject and intentionally put some friction in. You share Ed Catmull at Pixar and his brilliant track record making these amazing films. And that just is so counterintuitive to large organizations like Disney that bought them.
Right.
That lament how long it takes to make great stuff, but then they are surprised when they churn out crap that went fast, right?
Yes. So I got to know Ed, and Huggy got to know Ed pretty well over the years. And before, when he was president of Pixar, and after, we just talked to him regularly. And Ed is somebody who knows when to slow down. And it's not like he doesn't believe in efficiency. And the two times I would say, one's in the book, one is not. One is, when people talk to him about being efficient and speeding up making a film, he kind of glazes over and he says, well, we move as fast as we can, but we don't let things go until they meet our quality standards. We just have to keep iterating and iterating. And that's one that is very consistent with the academic research on creativity, which is it's fundamentally an inefficient process. I mean, it's filled with failure. It's filled with confusion. It's filled with dead ends. And it takes a long time to come up with things that actually work. So that's one example. There was another example, which just amazes me. So the way that I was raised as a sort of an organizational psychologist is there's a lot of evidence that says when somebody is not skilled at their job, you should fire them. Or at least give them a warning, get them out of the position, do it as quickly as possible. And if they're an airplane pilot or a surgeon, I think that makes sense, don't you? I mean, it's like you know about this stuff. You're in the healthcare industry. But we were talking to Ed about firing directors. And the way that it works when you're making a film like Ratatouille or The Incredibles or whatever, Monsters, Inc., is the director is sort of God. There may be input, but it's not a participative process. That person has final say in everything. And Ed has pointed out that when a director is going sideways, he will see the pattern earlier than other people work with them, but he doesn't jump in and fire the person. He will wait as long as 6 months or a year and have everything to go sideways. And he'll wait until everybody involved in the film comes to him and tells him, this director has to go, they are not competent. And then he will finally fire him. And so I look at him, I said, so Ed, so you just told me, given production costs, that you're willing to spend $3, $4, $5, $6 million to get everybody on board for not rushing in firing a director. And he said, that's right. It's worth it for the psychological safety in the culture. Because if I fire the person really quickly, when other people haven't accepted it yet, it creates fear throughout the organization. I'll lose my best people. People won't speak up during movies. They won't be as motivated. So it's worth it to us for the Pixar culture. Now that's a different way of thinking. that's not how people think in most companies.
No, so counterintuitive. And I love that. It takes longer, right, to do a bottom up where we have support with the entire group. But the results are so much more, you know, stable, right? This is, you're right. The minute top Brass goes. Everyone, oh, my next? Who's next? Or right. And then the rumor mill starts churning, and it's a team morale tanks. It's awful. That's really cool. I love that story.
I couldn't believe you told me that because it was a classic thing that I'm sitting around Ed's office, and I sort of said to Ed, "Well, so don't you just generally agree that and there's academic research to support this sort of for people who are in sales and in other occupations that when somebody isn't very good at something, you give them a quick warning." You put them on plan and then you fire them. And the quicker you do it, the better. And he said, well, not for directors. So I had this whole story.
I love that. I want to shift gears a little bit. I think you have taught in the book pretty well. I'll make sure I get it right. Anyone can be a friction fixer. We can think and act like one. And you share an example. I loved it. From the least likely place, your visit to the Department of Motor
Vehicles.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And there's also an addendum to the story. So around the time, I don't know, we're working on the book, and unfortunately during the course of the book, my 91-year-old mother passed away. So I'm the executor of her estate, and I'm dealing with like everybody, many people out there, I'm dealing with all little sort of pieces of things. And one was I had to go in person to the California Department of Motor Vehicles and to do something with their registration that required, I couldn't do it online. So I get there, it's 7:30 in the morning. As I expected, there's 60 people in line in front of me. And I'm psychologically prepared to be there till at least 10 if I'm lucky. And then at 7:40, this angel of a man, I eventually found out the guy's position is a greeter, walks out and walks down the line. He has a bunch of forms in his hand and he asks each of us why we are there. Some people he said to them, you can't be in line. There's no reason to be here. For example, you can't get a passport at the DMV. So that person had to go home. But for the rest of us, he'd give us the form to fill out. He'd tell us what window to go to when we got there. And so by the time when the doors opened at 8, I went straight to the window I was supposed to go to. And then that woman sent me to the next. It's 8:15 and I'm done. So I'm completely confused because, for example, I was having a terrible experience with Comcast that took a long time to untangle. And the DMV was much better than Comcast, for example. So that person, to your point that anybody can be a friction fixer, he took it upon him to be a trustee of other people's time. That's what he did. And to me, that's sort of the hallmark of what a friction fixer is. And to do a yes and, just in the last couple of months, Huggy and I and a student from Stanford are starting a case study of all of the steps that the Department of Motor Vehicles has taken to reduce the burden on employees and residents who use the Department of Motor Vehicles with technology, with routines, with culture. And it's very impressive. Steve Gordon, who's the head of the DMV, he has visited all 180 field offices and asked employees what he can do to make their jobs better, to make experiences better for customers. So it's pretty impressive given that it's this big bureaucracy and he and his team are making progress.
It's just so succinct and just powerful because it's the last place in the world. We've all had bad DMV experience. Well, I recently moved to Seattle, and I would tell you what the Department, State of Washington's got it really organized. They do a lot of what that greeter did. They're doing it online. So they give you a window, you show up, you're greeted, you go to the, I mean, I was shocked, but when I previously lived in Missouri, it's like, pack a lunch. You're going to be here
that's
for
the old hours. Way. It always was. I mean, just for example, there's something in the U.S. called Real ID that keeps getting pushed back, but it's required of a new identification required of every citizen. Yep. And you have to have a wet signature. So you have to go in to the office, and they have so much technology that it used to be 30 minutes was the average amount of time the person was at the DMV. Now it's 8 minutes. So that's awesome. Pretty good.
That's cool. Yeah, I just think, so if you're listening to this as an employee at a healthcare facility, a lot of our listeners are dentists and orthodontists, some are in medicine, and you think, well, that's for, someone who's trained in this to develop systems. You're really arguing that's not true. We can all do this. How we can all think and act like a friction fixer. So
Dustin, I know that you're supposed to be interviewing me, but I'm really curious in your world, what does good friction fixing look like?
Yeah, I think that not walking past the piece of trash, as you point out in the book, is like, it was like, oh, that's someone else's job. Or you shared some really great examples from physicians who we'll talk about the gross project, the getting rid of, you know, stupid stuff. It's really amazing. It's, I think, stepping up and saying, I see something that is displeasing to patients or is increasing wait times or that I'm hearing over and over again or a redundancy that we could, what could we eliminate? I lit up like a Christmas tree when I saw that you are fans of Lighty Klotz. Lighty's been on this show. So
that is asking awesome.
What can we get rid of? Every meeting starts with what can we do? What can we add? What new thing can we do? And it's like, wait. What could we get rid of, right? First of all, do we even need to be in this meeting? So I think speaking up is a big part of it. And then having that safety to say, I don't know why we're still using this form. Why are we? I see people, we do in-office consulting. We send trainers into offices. And we see, you're going to get kicked out of this. We see new patients coming in through a phone call. And we see that employee grab a phone slip because this thing's been around in our industry for decades. Uh-huh. So they grab this bright orange or bright yellow piece of paper that's supposed to signify to everyone around them that they're on a very important phone call, like the other phone calls aren't as important. But now they're writing down. They're getting the name. They're getting the address. They're getting who referred them. And I'm going, well, what do you do with that slip? They're like, well, then we type it into the computer. I'm like, well, what if we just typed it? What are you get it immediately. But they're like, but we have this slip. So we have to use this slip. And I go, well, let's just kill the slip. And they look at me like I'm from another planet asking them to take their firstborn child and drop it in the mouth of a volcano. I think because it's always been here. So I think the long answer, that's a long way. Short way, speaking up and asking, why are we doing it this way? And could we get rid of it?
So it's interesting you mentioned Lighty Klotz because what we're talking about here in a lot of these examples of friction fixing is essentially looking for opportunities to subtract. Yes. And so Lighty and I have gotten to know each other and have written a few things together. And and one of the things that so Lighty focuses more on we human beings are sort of wired to add rather than subtract. So, but if you prompt us and teach us, we might actually subtract. And then that's what his research shows. And then the stuff that we work on more is, well, what do organizations do to make this even worse? So a classic organization would have a rule and even reward the person who filled out the yellow slip and then typed it in the computer and would tell them they were doing it wrong if they just typed it in, right? So and there's some organizations that have, you know, rigid procedures like that. And another issue, and this is something since I'm in the university world, and it's also true of organizations like Google and Facebook too, is one of the things that happened with a lot of the organizations that we work with and the one that we work for, Stanford, is that they have a reward system where essentially if you are an administrator or a bureaucrat and the bigger fiefdom you build, the more you get paid.
Yes.
And so that could be whether you're in accounting, in law, writing code for Google. And there's no evidence that adding more and more people to a problem speeds it up. All the evidence is it actually slows it down. So you end up with these big complicated fiefdoms that slow things down even more quickly. So one of the things that Lighty and I talk about is suppose you looked at kind of everything you were doing and applied the rule of halves. What would it look like?
Yes.
And it's a pretty interesting thought experiment. And we've made some progress with that. Even my own university, I've gotten them to reduce some of the steps in, for example, promoting a new professor. So those are sort of thought experiments and more specific things you can do to move people from the addition mindset to the subtraction mindset.
Now, a quick word from our sponsor.
When's the last time you evaluated your credit card processing statement? Our partners at Stacks are offering a free savings analysis for our listeners, where they will actually take your merchant statement with your current processor and show you where you're overpaying. Stacks has saved orthodontics practices over 40% per month on payment processing costs. So don't wait. Get your free savings analysis today and see how much you're overpaying for your credit card processing. Go to stackspayments.com/Burleson-seminars to schedule your savings analysis today. Plus, as a special offer for our podcast listeners, if you sign up today, you can get your first 2 months of payments processing costs waived from Stacks. Once again, that's stackspayments.com/Burleson-seminars. Stop overpaying. Start saving.
And now, back to the program.
Yeah, and we're going to post in the show notes the links to, you've got all the classic literature. It's like a master class in the classic lit for business on how to do this. And then the work you've done with Lighty. And I love that rule of halves. We're going to link to that.
Great.
To continue this, don't you feel like, I mean, most people, they think, well, growth is just more, right? So we're going to like add this and add this. And you think of like General Electric, who like at one point in time was in the medical payments lending industry. Like they were one of the largest lenders for patient financing. They
spun
that off years ago. Yeah, it's wild. It was like this, like for them, a small division. It was like a multi-billion dollar division. And they realized like, what are we doing? And like, just because we make medical equipment doesn't mean we should be financing patients. Turned out around 2007, 2008, that became a horribly bad idea. But we all think to grow, well, let's just do more of what we've always been doing. In reality, you're arguing, Lighty's arguing, you might have to actually kill some stuff that you're currently doing, like GE saying, hey, we need to get out of this business entirely, right? Let's just spin it off.
Well, that's, I mean, the GE example to me, and I mean, there's famous cases in Silicon Valley, which is that very often a large legacy a large legacy business is dragging you down and you kind of let it go. So you can race off and do what's going to make you more money and be more interesting in the future. And I mean, the famous story there in Silicon Valley is Intel, that they had these sort of, low margin things called memory chips. And they also made semiconductors, which were high margin. This is a long time ago. And Gordon Moore, famous of Moore's Law, who was CEO, and Andy Grove, who was later CEO of Intel, they looked at each other and they said, so if we got fired, what would our competitors come in and do tomorrow? And it was get rid of memory chips. So instead of firing themselves, they got rid of memory chips. And as they say, the rest is history. That's how Intel got rid of memory chips and just pivoted to doing pure semiconductors. But that problem of when we're invested in something, it's always been part of our identity. It's very difficult to get rid of it sometimes.
Yeah, but it can sometimes be so simple. You quote a study that should be near and dear to the hearts and minds of all of our listeners. In 2019, JAMA found that doctors devoted 43% of their time to updating the electronic record and only 13% to providing direct patient care. Can we talk about Dr. Melinda Ashton, how she became a friction fixer? I'm thinking of the one example you showed, like just saving a click, just one click on when a diaper was changed in the NICU. It saved like 1,700 nursing hours a month.
1,700 nursing hours. So this is interesting too, because to us, and one of the questions here, and I'm sure for many of your listeners, is this a top-down or a bottom-up sort of change? And I think in the best situations, it's both. Because what Dr. Melinda Ashton did, and this was published in the Journal of American Medical Association, a respected journal, they tell me, and it's called the Get Rid of Stupid Stuff project. And what she did was she was head of quality at Hawaii Pacific, the largest healthcare chain in the Hawaiian Islands. And she said to her healthcare workers, what should we get rid of? What's dumb? What's in the way in our electronic medical records? Got about 188 suggestions. And then her team started trying to implement them, including, as you say, getting rid of a click for changing diapers, getting rid of a click for when there's patient rounds. And the amount of time that was saved was quite substantial. And so I tend to have people in the companies I work with play this subtraction game. But my co-author, Helgi Rao, who's a little bit more bolder than I am, he'll say, let's start out and talk about all this stupid stuff in your company that's driving you crazy. And then boom, that's a sign that maybe you should get rid of some of that stuff.
That'll get people talking real quick.
Yeah,
I love it. You go back to the DMV. Yeah, he actually went and visited all those locations. That's how you know. You've got to go listen. It's really, really powerful. I know, listener, there's so much in the book I could talk to you for days and days and days. I want to highlight, we're not going to get through all of them, but I want to highlight that listeners go get the book and read it and talk about. I do want to at least mention in the book, you say we can be guided by three convictions. And then we're going to kind of maybe touch on some of the traps. There's five prevalent traps. But what are the three convictions if we want to actually go take action? Or if someone goes, you know what? I've got some really stupid stuff going on in my practice. I'd like to get rid of some clicks. How can these convictions guide us to take action?
Well, some of the convictions, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to, but that's what happens when you have authors. We sometimes forget what's in our books. But some of the convictions that I think are important. One of the first ones is that first of all, to see yourself as a trustee of others' time. Yes. So that's one that's important. That is just to realize that that's part of your job as a human being, no matter where you are. A second one has to do with accountability. One of the issues that that we see in friction fixing over and over again, it's often an orphan problem. People point the finger of blame at others and say it's others' fault. And this is not just people who are lower levels of organizations. I've heard CEOs of Fortune 10 companies say, I'd like to get rid of the friction here, but the trolls in the organization won't let me, by which he meant the middle managers.
Yep.
And then the third conviction, which I think is more about discipline that I would emphasize, is it's like mowing the lawn. There is no one and done when it comes to this. It's in many things in work or in life are like this. It's a discipline you have to do over and over again. And the example we used there was when it came to meetings, we worked with a company called Dropbox, the storage, online storage stuff, a company that many of your probably listeners know about.
Yeah.
They did a fantastic job of going in and taking meetings, standing meetings out of everybody's calendars. It was called our meeting Geddon. They couldn't re-enter them for 2 weeks. They changed the norms to try to reduce the number of extra meetings. And it was really cool. Things were really better for a while. But then by the time we talked to the CEO, Drew Houston, a year later, we said, how's it going? He said, it's worse than ever. You've got to keep mowing the lawn. You can't just do it once. So yeah, at least when I think of convictions, and I think we might have said a little bit differently in the book, but those are some of the things that to me that are important for having a culture and a discipline of friction fixing.
Yeah, no, you nailed them. Maybe that was Huggy's research team and I'm asking on something, but that I wrote it down and I think it could go up on the wall. Like, you got to constantly mow the lawn. This isn't like you go away for a retreat and you talk about this stuff and you give the example of a pit crew, like in NASCAR or Formula One. You say scheduling regular pit stops is like mandatory. And then you're searching for signs that it's time for emergency repairs. But I think at least our listeners, I hope it's not having a Fortune 100 companies or, you know, like in surgical suites, but I think we kind of run from fire to fire. And
right.
We kind of put a tourniquet on whatever emergency is at hand. And that's just not a way to run a system. That's not a way to actually eliminate friction. It's not scalable. It's not repeatable. And so I love the NASCAR and mowing the lawn example, and people should just kind of write it down and ask themselves, like, when's the last time we mowed the lawn? And you're like, oh yeah, we're back to weekly meetings where there's 30 people in the room and half the team doesn't even know why they're there. You shared some examples. I think it was Dropbox. Maybe it's Amazon with Bezos's two pizza rule. But like, if you're in a meeting and you're like, I don't have anything to add here, like, you should be able to get up and leave.
Yeah, so that to me is a sign of a healthy organization. And at various times in my career, I have, and this is self-subtraction, I guess, I've talked about the virtues of managing by walking out of the room, which seems to horrify people. But I think in a really great organization, and I realize not everybody can do this, if you're not being useful, there's an argument for you leaving. And where I actually first saw this was one of my heroes and mentors. I'm actually going to see him tomorrow, David Kelly, who founded the Stanford Design School and also the famous design firm IDEO. I watched David for years. He'd bring together groups of people, let's just say engineers and clients, for example, and have them start talking about a problem. He'd set up the problem and he'd move to the back of the room. He'd make sure they were humming and he'd leave. And I'd say, David, you walked out of the room. And he said, yeah. He said, I'm wasting my time there. And besides, since I'm the boss, I'll intimidate the folks. They'll do better if I'm not in the room. So I always thought I always think about, when is it best to manage by walking out of the room?
Yeah, that's a sign of a great leader, right? And one of those traps you mentioned in the book, there's five. They're brilliant. The price of the book could be multiples of what it is. Could add a few zeros to it, still be worth it. Leaders who are oblivious, I'm thinking back to our intro to this conversation.
Right.
With a 1,200 some word. I mean, like, if you're writing 1,200 word emails, like, give me a break. No one's reading that. Right. You share an example of the doctor, the CEO, the hospital administrator, and they started calling him Dr. TLDR.
Dr. TLDR, yes. We all know Dr. TLDR. Yes.
But we think, okay, this is important. I'm just going to send it to everyone so we're all on the quote same page. And I'm like, what's that same page? We're all frustrated and horrified. Right. You're asking us to come in on a Saturday. Is this paid time? We're just gonna like read thousands of words. So oblivious leaders is one. You say addition sickness is the other. We're not gonna get into all these, but there at times we're all guilty of these, having broken connections. I love the phrase jargon monoxide. We all get in our own world.
Broken connections is really important since you're in healthcare.
Yes.
And we actually use a lot of healthcare examples in that chapter. In healthcare, it's so difficult, and you know this so much better than I do. There's all these different pieces, and there's so much friction because they're glued together so badly. And just, you know, the classic two-sentence summary that I hear from one venture capitalist after another, who, by the way, few are fixing it, is healthcare is a problem of friction and fragmentation.
Yeah.
And so people who sort of are good at developing system knowledge and figuring out how to improve the handoffs, that's where a lot of the solutions to healthcare are that might actually work. And there are some signs that there are progress, at least in some places. So that's one that I think is really important. And I know that you struggle with it in your work all the time.
We do. And I was listening to an interview at Wharton School of Business on one of the largest employers of physicians, saying it's so hard to scale excellence. Every time we find an exceptional team, it's riding on the back of a few exceptional individuals. These would be the friction fixers. And we try to take that, whatever they're doing, and bring it to the next team. And they haven't figured out how fragmented this world is. And in America, it's really not health insurance. It's healthcare access.
Right.
You know, it all gets kicked down the road eventually for Medicare to pick it up. I read recently that the average U.S. employee is on their health plan for like 3.75 years. So those insurers know they're not going to be covering long care, chronic conditions. They know the hip replacement and the expensive stuff is going to be Medicare's problem. And that's baked into the system. So it's really wild how much, to you point out, friction and fragmentation there is in our world, and how it really does fall on our backs to step up and say, I see something that we can do better. And I'm not going to keep stealing patients' time. I'm not going to keep wasting my coworkers' time.
Right.
And we can be that source of action. And it's just really inspiring. So yeah, I love, you've got a lot of healthcare examples in the book. So if you're listening, please, please, please get through particularly the section on the acronym GROSS, getting rid of stupid stuff, which is the best acronym ever. And you can today make some steps in the right direction. I want to make sure we give time for our listeners to learn more about you or go get the book. Anything you want to finish, I'll leave the last few moments to you to share what you're working on next and how they can learn more about you.
Oh, so I've been an organizational psychologist for about 45 years. So I've studied various elements of the workplace, but I think that almost all my work is at the intersection between what do I do as a leader that affects my team, and then how does my team interplay with the organization. So I'm always interested in how the organization's structured, and what my team or what I can do to make it better, or sometimes worse, from where I'm at. And I think that's, you can hear this in the friction fixing, in our scaling work. I'm probably most famous for writing a book about workplace jerks, but to me, it's they're all sort of similar problems. And the best place to find me, just bobsutton.net is my website, and that's where you can find stuff. And to me, I'm just somebody who's always curious about, gee, what can I learn about making work both more efficient and more humane. And I was raised by my late dissertation advisor, Bob Kahn. He lived to be 101. And every conversation I ever had with him, that's always what he was concerned about. Yes, we want work to be efficient, but it's possible to make it humane too. And if we're not doing both, we're not doing it right. So that's my sort of little life mission that I learned from my dissertation advisor.
That's excellent. I had so much fun. Thank you for what you're doing. Thanks for the work for the book. You're adding not only to your specialty and profession, but to the world at large. It's just so much fun. I could talk to you for days and days, Bob. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thanks, Dustin. It was great to talk with you.
You've been listening to another episode of The Burleson Box. A special thank you to all of you who have subscribed and left reviews of the show. It means a lot. And a special thank you to Bob Sutton for coming on the show. I had so much fun. Please check out Bob's website at bobsutton.net. Get the book, The Friction Project, and I can't wait to see you right here next time inside another episode of The Burleson Box.
Are you trying to increase your treatment plan close rates while also increasing revenue? How can you do both for your dental practice without burning out an already burdened staff? The answer? Remote dental monitoring. You need a trusted HIPAA-compliant app that helps you and your staff work smarter, not harder. This needs to be an easy-to-use, easy-onboard app that your patients will find fun to use and will increase their engagement and success with aligners. You need the InHand Dental app. The InHand Dental app allows you to engage with your patients in real time, send individual and batched messages, and solve problems to increase compliance without using up chair time. The result? Happy patients, happy staff, and happy practices. With more revenue and the ability to do more starts. With prices starting as low as $149 a month, it's perfect for a growing aligner business. Check us out and learn more at InHandDental.com. Plus, mention Burleson for a 20% off discount on your subscription when you contact us. That's InHandDental.com.